just a moment, keys to the Capitol. But first, a word to you sports fans. This Friday night, the cavalcade of sports takes you direct to ringside at the famous Philadelphia Arena. There you'll hear a blow-by-blow account of the 10-round main event, the heavyweight battle between Harold Johnson and Billy Smith. From the opening bell right through to the finish, you'll hear every exciting minute, and you'll hear all the color and tension that accompany a match between two top-rated heavyweights. It's boxing coverage at its very best, brought to you every Friday night by the Cavalcade of Sports. Be on hand this Friday night. And now, stay tuned for Keys to the Capitol on NBC.
What's going on in Washington?
Well, everyone says fine to rearming Western Germany, but there's a question.
Integration a serious headache, true or false?
The McCarthy censure, what will happen?
Eisenhower's the issue. What if the Republicans lose?
NBC brings you Keys to the Capitol, a transcribed program of informal discussion by NBC Washington reporters and commentators dealing with issues and measures facing the public. We've given these correspondents the assignment of taking you with them behind official doors where opinions are formed and policies are formulated. Tonight you'll hear Arthur Barrio, Richard Harkness, Herb Kaplow, Earl Godwin, and Leif Eve in an exchange of fact and opinion on controversies and problems current in national affairs. Listen now to Keys to the Capitol. First, here is NBC Washington correspondent Arthur Barrio.
The fellows knowing this group, I don't imagine it would be at a loss for words even if nothing had been going on. The truth to tell, I think a lot has happened.
Well, I did. Don't you appreciate that statement, Leif?
Truth to tell, a lot has happened since we got together 2 weeks ago. We've had this nine-power conference in London. Here at home, the question of integration in the schools has certainly had its dramatic moments. We find Senator McCarthy still controversial, with the Senate coming back to act on this censure proposition. And as we are all well aware of the fact, the political bandwagons have been rolling. Well, to begin with, Dick, how about furnishing some international flavor here and telling us how this London conference appears to you?
Well, I think rather than how it appears to me, Arthur, the important thing is that this week the statesmen have been trotting out the superlative to praise the agreement to rearm Western Germany. For instance, President Eisenhower called the London conference one of the greatest diplomatic achievements of our time. Of course, there is the positive side to this treaty. 12 more divisions for Western European defense, a central division. Another point is that this is an agreement reached by the Europeans themselves. Now, Secretary of State Dulles gave the French, he gave the Germans a warning at London. He said, "You agree on giving Germany an army, or the U.S. will withdraw from Europe." Now, from then on, Secretary Dulles sat back. Anthony Eden, European, pledged for Britain indefinite presence of 4 British divisions plus air power on the continent. Premier Mendes France, then old Chancellor Adenauer, took it from there. So, Allied occupation of West Germany will cease. Germany comes into NATO as a full free partner with 500,000 troops. From there on, to hear and read the reactions, it's all beer and sausages. But it may not be quite so palatable as that. We have now put ourselves in this position. We have now given the West Germans everything in our power to give them. But that is not the case when it comes to Russia. For instance, Russia alone can give West Germany unification with East Germany, something that every German wants. Russia alone can return to a united Germany, her eastern territory handed over to the Poles at the end of the war. Now that the West Germans have everything they can get from us, I think there's a very serious question. Will the Germans now look to the east? If they do, we're in for a lot of trouble.
Dick, I was concerned primarily what the difference was between this and the EDC, whether it was a better agreement or a worse one.
Well, it's a better agreement, Herb, since we couldn't get to EDC. But I think that's the only reason. EDC was our goal. It was a key of American foreign policy. And our statesmen, Mr. Dulles, Mr. Eisenhower, hated to see it go for a very simple and, I think, practical reason. That EDC went well beyond the London Conference Treaty because EDC had the political unification, looking forward to a United States of Europe. And I think, as we know, it's been proven by history, that you cannot have a full defense alliance. You can't have the strongest possible defense alliance unless you have a political alliance. Of course, from a standpoint of realistic French politics, Mendes France couldn't get it. So this is the next best thing. As I said, to put a cap on that, Washington would much rather had a full EDC, a European Defense Community.
In the last few months, of course, it seemed to me that that was a little bit unrealistic of the President and Mr. Dulles to expect that the European nations would give up some of their national sovereignty to go into a political union, as nationalistic as they are over there. We know how we'd feel if somebody came over here and proposed that we go in, say, with Argentina or something like that, give up some of our sovereignty. And I think that a lot of the realism had gone out of EDC long before, while our people were still clinging to the idea that there was a chance, don't you?
Oh, I quite agree with you, Leif. I think it was obvious to every reporter in Paris and in Europe that EDC would not go through the French Assembly well before it was apparent to Mr. Eisenhower and Mr. Dulles. Now, who's to blame? I don't know. I've heard reports that our State Department got very bad advice, very bad information from our people in Paris. If that's the case, I think some heads should roll. If those observers over there, trained as they're supposed to be, couldn't see that, I think they'd better come on home.
Well, of course, there was a belief, I believe, that Mondes France did not push the EDC plan as much as our State Department people would have liked him to push it. Mondes France himself claimed that he could not get EDC through Parliament.
Well, yes, but our people should have known that from any practical political standpoint in France, Mondes France, no other French premier could have gotten EDC through and had his government stand.
The State Department, of course, some of the people there may believe that had he pushed it, they would have got it through.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that through all of this controversy, France has more or less stood accused of dragging her feet in the thing. In a way, I don't think you can blame her too much. She's been attacked twice now and is bound to have some fear of the...
Three times,
that's right. She's been attacked and she's bound to have some fear of the Germans.
Of course, that's a basic reason. That goes back to what Lee said. It's another point, another reason why we should not have placed our whole European foreign policy on EDC over this long period.
Dick, there was a little item today about Molotov. He's in East Germany now. He's renewed his call for a four-power conference on reuniting Germany. See, that's the first move he picked up.
And Mr. Molotov is not a talkative gentleman at all. And when he talks, he has a very real reason.
If they reunite from the Russian standpoint, it's goodbye France, and...
Well, certainly, but this is just something to block this treaty.
Yeah, certainly, because if you ever put the technique and the know-how of the Germans with the mass power of the Russians, the free world is in one very bad, dangerous situation.
Of course, the element here of Britain taking part in this new plan seems to be an extremely significant one, and I think probably much of the West is putting great stock in that as being one of the reasons why this treaty while it may not be exactly what we wanted in EDC, nevertheless, is a very strong and potent force.
Yeah, that's something that the French have been demanding ever since the end of the First World War. They asked, I think it was Clemenceau who asked the United States for guarantees at that time to go along with the Versailles Treaty. He would give a much softer treaty if Woodrow Wilson would agree to back France up.
Yeah,
would stay in there.
That was a complete about-face on British foreign policy. One made in the British own self-interest. They realized, finally, their interest on the continent of Europe. Every war in Europe, they become involved in it. That's really what put it over. It goes back to my point that this was an agreement by the Europeans, which makes it, I think, more important than if we'd rammed it down their throats.
Well, diplomats have done their best with it anyhow, I guess. But Herb, I understand that you've been commuting back and forth to Milford, Delaware, and you've really been in on these integration demonstrations and also attending a few here in the capital. How does the situation look to you?
Well, I think it's probably safe to characterize the most of all as being somewhat confusing. It's hard to figure out just how many students honestly oppose integration, how many are motivated mainly because they just want some plain excitement, how many don't want to get read out of their gang for giving in, that is, for going back to school. Well, how many are staying home because their folks don't want them to take a chance of getting hurt, how many are in school, and how the Negro children themselves are reacting to all of this. Those are just some of the confusing elements you run into when you go out and observe one of these demonstrations. But on the broader scope of this whole problem of integration, there's the question of just how much of a reaction to the Supreme Court decision is there really, in fact? Well, with these specific and general questions in mind, the whole subject might rather easily be portrayed way out of its proper perspective. And so, we as newsmen are faced with what which certainly is a more pressing need for sizing the whole question up and the whole problem up right. It also seems to me, incidentally, and maybe this is a prejudice view as a reporter, that the general public has its responsibility, too, not to get distorted impressions, not to let itself get in distorted impressions because of these few attention-getting demonstrations. I remember, you probably do too, that it was right after the Supreme Court delivered that decision, that the comments from the pros and the antis alike, that this calls for dispassionate, sober thought. And by and large, I think that's probably what's been taking place, with, of course, a few obvious exceptions. Of course, integration has not been put in effect in many places yet. That should be recognized. One point, I think, hasn't sunk in with all the people yet, especially with those who are actively opposing integration, many of the people taking part in these demonstrations. The Supreme Court ruled against segregation, and that's just about it. There may be dissatisfaction with, well, the way some of the people put it, with those nine men way off in Washington trying to tell us how to run our schools, the schools we pay for, not them. But after all, the Supreme Court is the final court, and there's little, if any, chance of its ruling being reversed. I don't know if it's ever, the Supreme Court has ever had its decision questioned by anybody else, and it's like talking to an umpire. There's never a change of decision.
No, they change from time to time.
And the court has changed.
Well, they change from time to time.
It's hardly ever in the same generation.
No, that's right.
No, it takes a long time for them to change their opinions, but they have changed.
Well, there's still another element to consider, and that is that there's no point in trying to ignore the problem as such. In some areas, especially those where there is a large Negro population, it is a serious problem, and it should be looked at in the light of the traditional beliefs and the traditional patterns of the area. Altogether, there are lots of different angles to consider, but it seems to me that the relationship of the Negro and white races in our country is going one way toward more equality, and while there may be disturbances from time to time and maybe setbacks, that seems to be the course. We can only hope that all of us can adjust to it, whatever it will be.
My impression is that this thing has sort of spread like an epidemic. West Virginia, Delaware, Baltimore, and then Washington. You can almost trace this germ of demonstration as it's gone. I have an opinion, and more of a feeling, I suppose, a hunch, that this is something like the panty raid. It started at one school a couple of years ago, remember, and spread all over the
it
country.
It reminds me of a rally after a football.
Yeah, funny, psychology gets out of hand. And one thing that struck me is the way, the calm way that this was taken publicly here in Washington. The radio stations, television stations treated it very calmly and coldly as a news story. Two of the three Washington newspapers put the story exactly where it belonged. That was back with the local news inside. There was no big front page scare story. I think this is purely a passing phase.
It's the young people's thing. The older folks aren't yet taking so much interest in this thing. Out in Delaware they did, but here in Washington it seems to be almost entirely the students.
Well, there have been a lot of adults on the sidelines here in Washington.
Yeah, these things wouldn't happen unless the parents were behind it.
I was just going to say, Earl, I think in this case many of the adults are to blame. Now, I know there's one little episode over here in our southeast section. They had a clergyman who was talking to these school children, trying to get them to go back to their classes. And there are a couple of adults there. Let's not call them adults. Let's call them rabble-rousers. Excuse me. Let's call them rabble-rousers. And they'd poke these kids in the ribs and say, ask them this. And then they'd poke another kid in the ribs and say, ask them that. Just trying to create this disturbance. And as I say,
the parents should say would have sort of a negative effect on them. They weren't telling them to go to school. They were just okay at what they did.
If the parents wanted... I don't know how many hundred. That's always been a question, how many are actually out. But if the parents had insisted that these children go to school, they would have gone to school. But there were several of them out. Several of them, of course, claim that their parents were with them. There were adults in these groups who were certainly lending very definite support to these young boys and girls.
Then we had the telephone calls from mothers who said that they had known that this was coming along several days in advance.
That's
they'd
right.
got telephone calls and talked it over, you know, in their afternoon meetings and so forth. So they knew it was coming. So this is a reflection of the adults' opinion largely, it seems to me, that's carried over into the children.
It's quite a frightening experience, actually, to go out and see this. I guess it's like probably any incident of mass action where things get out of hand and there's almost a disregard for law.
Only the hectic days in which we live. seem to hop from one controversy to another. Speaking of controversies, Earl, how about this Watkins Committee in the Senate coming back to work on the censure report? What's going to happen?
When they come back on November 8th to meet on this McCarthy censure report, Senator Watkins of Utah, who's chairman of that select committee of six, will present appropriate resolutions to make the recommendations effective, and that is a censure on two counts, and ask for a vote. Then will come the avalanche. In time, McCarthy will jump into the fray with a battle cry that the fight on communism must not be hindered, and he will have support. He will have support from Dirksen of Illinois and perhaps others. And the McCarthy opponents will be there with all the allegations that underlay the original charges, about half a hundred of them, and there will be probably all kinds of motions and parliamentary maneuvers to delay, destroy, divert, denounce, and... You've read about the March on Washington that's been proposed by an anti-communist group. It could be expected that an opposition anti-McCarthy column will come along with its march, and there's building up also a rash of criticism of the previous administrations, alleging pro-communist influence in foreign policy and in the strategy of the Korean War, and this will be heard, I think, come out in the Senate debate with corresponding fervent defense. In common parlance, with all that has been said on this subject, you just ain't seen anything yet.
Earl, I know that... Excuse me?
Well, I'm going to say that the present assumption is that the censure resolutions will be upheld, although a majority will vote for censure. But there have been some interesting departures from the routine and the normal in the past, and that makes it not quite certain.
I know this will be sheer guess, Earl, but how long do you think this Senate session will last?
Well, I hadn't any of my independent thought on it. I consulted some of the experts, Senate staff fellows this morning, and they said it could last a month.
That's what I heard.
A month.
Yeah, that they were talking about a month long.
Yeah.
Because the defense will be very long.
Oh, yes.
Mm. Yes, I think it may even amount to, in effect, to a filibuster, don't you?
Sure. It'll be a bitter thing. I don't know if there's anything more bitter than something which is in history, and that was the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. It was frightfully bitter. This could be quite as bitter.
Well, it's not. I don't think it's as
it
a big thing.
It's not as
nearly as big
as it's quite.
It's smaller, but it's violent.
It'll be violent and bitter. I'm sorry to say.
Well, certainly. Excuse me, Art.
I was going to say the pro-McCarthy marchers say they want a peaceful and dignified operation down here, but if the anti-McCarthy marches come in, I wonder just how peaceful it will be if they all tangle together up there on the hill.
One interesting thing to me is that, assuming Senator McCarthy, which seems to be a very certain assumption as of today, there are those in the Senate on the anti-McCarthy side who then want to go ahead after the censor motions are adopted and put in a resolution directing Senator McCarthy to appear before that Senate subcommittee and answer questions regarding his finances.
The one that he ducked.
And that would put up very squarely to Senator McCarthy and to the Senate the question of contempt, because as I understand Senator McCarthy's position, he said that he will not reveal his finances, the contributions to him to fight communism.
Is that committee still in existence, Vic?
Committee's still in existence. Not the same people on it, of course, Earl, because of control of Congress. Another little sidelight there is that some talk in the Senate about stripping Senator McCarthy of his committee chairmanship. Of course, if the election goes as the Democrats say it will, that will all be hypothetical.
That
would be John McClellan would be in charge then if the Democrats take over.
McCarthy will still be on the committee unless they make changes. He isn't riveted to that job.
No, he can be taken off by the leadership or the Senate by a simple majority vote can remove a man.
This thing, of course, has a lot of unpredictable elements. I just wonder if this thing did run into a month-long session, would it be to the benefit of Senator McCarthy or not? It would seem that at the present time it pretty much rests with him. He is the factor who is determining just how long the Senate will discuss this matter. Is it conceivable that the effect censure would have on him would not be so severe that it would warrant him going into a long defense at this time? Perhaps the results of that might be more damaging than actually accepting the censure.
Well, I suppose there is a risk of that, but on the other hand, they say that Senator McCarthy has said that one of his main points is going to be to bring to the attention of the Senate the dangerous precedent that would be set if he is censured for these things. And the longer he carries on that fight, Uncle, we might convince some people. Well, maybe we better not, you know.
Well, wouldn't you think that a man in Senator McCarthy's position and facing this likely censure, would his strategy be to put himself in a position before the country of being a martyr for his fight against communism? Would that be the underlying Senator McCarthy strategy? And that his friends would play along that strategy line?
Well, Dick, I have thought of that. I've never thought of it in exactly the words that you put it up. Would that be his strategy? But I have thought that events could turn around so that the public would accept him, a large part of the public would accept him as a martyr.
Well, there certainly have been indications of that. His statement that his defense will largely concern that the people who have more or less instituted or been largely responsible for these charges, the people who are, well, I don't want to misquote anybody, but something to the effect, people who did not want to see the fight against communism continue. Was that a pretty accurate description?
Oh, I don't think so, because it certainly does not apply to Senator Watkins and the members of that committee.
In that respect, it's hard to see how the fight against communism has got anything to do with this at all, because the Watkins committee was very, very strict in ruling out that question.
But what my point was is that point was made by Senator McCarthy.
Yes, yeah, it was. He tried to introduce it at the very outset of the hearing. Then the committee said that has nothing to do with it.
And that would be along the martyr line.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, he makes it. His man Friday, ex-man Friday, Roy Cohn, made it again last night. Whenever they had that dinner where he was... It seems to be their stock in trade or their battle cry.
But Earl, how do you connect that? How do you connect this fight on communism with the Watkins recommendation?
You can't say that
Watkins is pro-communist.
Not with the
nor any of the rest, can
he? Not directly with the report, but it just McCarthy will take the position that anything that interferes with us is interfering with our fight on communism. He will just make that statement in some language, probably at great length.
Well, can you rule out the charges
or not?
I mean, the
responsible for the charges having been filed might have subscribed to that.
I think his approach will be, won't it, that he actually has done nothing that other senators have not done in the past. And they were not censored, that he was. Therefore, people are shooting at him because of his fight against communism, but he's been singled out for this particular attack. I think that will be Senator McCarthy's line.
Yes, at the hearings themselves, he claimed he was not allowed to make that point. Watkins ruled that only the chairman of the senatorial committee, not an individual senator's actions, could be referred to.
Well, I think maybe he can bring up one very interesting one. Pat McCarran, who died the other day, once had the Spanish ambassador in a closed executive meeting of his own committee while he was questioning the State Department people on why they didn't give more help to Spain. So he can bring up some very interesting precedents.
Well, the elections will be over when the Senate does come back, but meantime, out there now are the voters, a leaf loved by all politicians at this season.
You know some voters, Lee?
Yeah. How about these campaigns, Lee?
Well, I think we're really getting into it now. You know, the candidates are enlightening the people on the issues, and the people are soberly pondering the future course of the nation. I see where somebody in the crowd threw some ripe tomatoes at Senator Ives up in New York, where he's running for governor, and Senator Ives promptly labeled the opposition skunks. But seriously, I think we are coming to grips with things in this year's campaign. In the various states, the campaigns are shaping up, and we're getting our first indication on how things are going. Charlie Halleck, the majority leader of the House, when he was out to see the president in Denver, said, "Right now the situation looks rough for the Republicans." Well, it seemed to me that the Republican campaign is the more interesting of the two from the professional standpoint. The president insisted on making himself, his administration, and the whole Eisenhower record the main Republican issue of the year. And he and his close associates succeeded pretty well in doing that. From everything we've heard, most Republican candidates have gone along and they're out there on the stump saying, if you voters want the Eisenhower program to go forward, then vote Republican. Well, that makes this far more than usual in the off-year election, a sort of a national referendum on how President Eisenhower has been running the country.
Of course, there are all sorts of local issues, but this is the dominant issue. The Republicans are running on a million-arc platform, hoping that the president's popularity will rub off on them as individuals. I don't think it's been working as well as they thought it would. It's always hard for a president in an off-year election to rub off some of his own prestige and his own popularity on the local candidate. And we had that Halleck comment after the long talk with the president. A day or so ago, Vice President Nixon said the president would be making at least 3 more speeches before Election Day. The summer White House said the president is considering invitations to speak. The top leaders are gathering at Denver on Friday to talk matters over. Now, if everything were going satisfactorily for the Republicans, I don't think you'd find this sudden flurry of activity. It's obvious that the president is going to have to pitch in considerably more than he figured on. He's having to put his prestige on the line in an off-year election when the odds are traditionally against the party in power. Well, that raises an interesting question. What if the usual happens? What if the incumbent Republicans lose the election and the control of Congress? What happens then to the prestige that the president is now putting on the line? What do you think, Dick?
I don't think it will damage President Eisenhower's personal prestige with the people very much. President Truman came through after losing a Congress, remember? The Republican idiot Congress. It turned, as a matter of fact, to Mr. Truman's personal political advantage when he ran for president again. So I think that we sit here in Washington and attach too much importance to the president's personal prestige as an issue. Whereas, as we all know, if we'll just stop and think, that certainly elections to the House, and to a large extent elections to the Senate, are determined pretty largely on local issues.
Mm-hmm.
It's undoubtedly good campaign strategy for Mr. Eisenhower to lay his program on the line, so to speak. But I think that actually it is not on the line. And while we may all write and broadcast and so forth afterwards that the president has suffered a defeat, I think that will not be so.
If you were running for Congress, and say you were a Republican, and in a district very close, and you were running with every effort you had, and your heart was beating, and your breath was putting around, you'd just love it if some big voice like Eisenhower say, "Help Dick."
Yes, sir. I'd like to be on the platform with his that good arm right on my shoulder. I'd be right on those coattails. That's one of the Republican objections to get President Eisenhower, that he's up making these speeches on a broad basis, but that he's not going on the platform and putting his arm around the candidate and say, "Here's my good friend Joe. Vote for Joe. I need Joe in Washington." He hasn't gotten down to that level.
Dick, that raises still another question. You know, the professional politicians, well, Eisenhower is not a professional, have done that in the past. Now, he hasn't. You mentioned Harry Truman coming back after the Idiot Congress. Now, if Harry Truman was a professional politician, he got in there and he started slugging right off the bat. He saw his chance for the following election. Now, is Eisenhower likely to do that?
Well, I think myself, I'd like to be a fly on the wall at this strategy session they're going to have out in Denver. I'll tell you that, because I think he's going to be urged to do it. There isn't much time remaining.
Some remark ought to be made about you, but it's a skinny right.
Go ahead. Well, you know,
having to do with weight?
I was rather surprised a few days ago to find out that the primary figures were surprisingly low.
You have been listening to Keys to the Capitol, brought to you transcribed by NBC News, as a way of taking you behind the doors of official Washington with NBC's top reporters and commentators. Tonight you heard Lee Feed, Earl Godwin, Herbert Kaplow, Richard Harkness, and Arthur Berrio. Keys to the Capitol will be brought to you at the same time each week. This is the NBC Radio Network.